Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 262. It's Monday, June 24th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get up with an Ohio Plus story. This from the Environmental Health Network. Pollution from Ohio train derailment spread to 16 states. A new study reveals that pollution from the East Palestine train derailment in February 2023 spread over 16 states, impacting 14% of the U.S. with unusual but not toxic concentrations. There's the phrase for the day. Of course, most pollution, air pollution and otherwise, kills you through chronic exposures over time rather than killing you all at once in an acute fashion. Well, and of course, some people believe that doesn't what kill you makes you stronger, but with pollution, usually it just kills you much more slowly. Okay, the train accident in East Palestine, Ohio, released pollutants that spread across 16 states. Pollutants were detected as far as South Carolina, Wisconsin, and New England, covering 540,000 square miles. Although concentrations were low, they were unusually high compared to normal levels, with potential impacts on marine and plant life. And I would add, of course, human life. Okay, well, next up, want to do a quick summary of some of the findings of the state of global air for 2024. This is from the Health Effects Institute and the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. First up, second largest risk factor of death in 2021, which is the most recent data we have globally. So that means air pollution is the second leading risk factor for death in the world. Yikes. And if you put that in context, the global risk factors for death, the top five, number one, high blood pressure, whew, the silent killer. Two, air pollution. Three, tobacco. Four, diet. And five, high fasting plasma glucose, which of course is diabetes or pre-diabetes. And air pollution killed 8.1 million people in 2021 globally. 58% of those deaths are from ambient PM2.5. That's the smallest particles that go easily into your lungs and bloodstream. 38% of that comes from household air pollution. And 6% of deaths come from ozone. And of respiratory disease, air pollution is responsible for 30% of deaths from lower respiratory infections, 28% of deaths from heart disease, and 48% of deaths from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, what we used to call asthma. And to top all this up, of course, these risks are not distributed evenly, and populations from low and middle income countries are exposed to 1.3 to 4 times the levels of ambient PM2.5, those smallest and most dangerous air pollution particles. Okay, well, of course, those top five global risk factors for death just really highlight the fact that what we eat and what we breathe are huge, with high blood pressure, air pollution, tobacco, diet, and high blood sugar all. And of course, the high blood sugar and the high blood pressure are also very tightly closely related to diet as well. It's hard to tease those out sometimes. Okay, next up, sticking to some respiratory issues, this from MedPage Today. Striking disparities in specialty care for kids with asthma on public insurance. Children with asthma were substantially less likely to see outpatient specialists if they had Medicaid rather than private health insurance, a cross-sectional study revealed. In an analysis of child year observations in the Massachusetts All-Payer Claims Database from 2014 to 2020, specialty care was reported in 12% of the publicly insured as compared to 21% of the privately insured. We found striking disparities in the receipt of specialist care based on insurance type, despite children with Medicaid having higher rates of persistent asthma, the researchers wrote in JAMA Network Open. Contrary to expectations, disparities in specialist care by insurance type were even more striking in children with persistent asthma. Although most children with asthma are successfully treated by primary care clinicians, guidelines recommend an asthma specialist referral when there is poor control despite evidence-based management. Furthermore, they noted, Medicaid disproportionately insures kids from minority, racial, and ethnic groups, children already at higher risk for asthma and asthma exacerbations. Okay, well, next up, we're going to turn to the American diet, which is often referred to as the SAD diet, the standard American diet. But hey, our report card has perhaps gotten just a little bit better. This from CNN. America's diet quality turned from an F to a D. Here's how to turn yours into an A. There's a crack of light shining through dark clouds of America's battle with poor nutrition and subsequent health issues, according to a new study that analyzed two decades of nutritional data. There is good news. Americans are starting to hear the message about nutrition, and some companies and restaurants are starting to make healthier products. It's a little bit of an improvement, said senior study author and cardiologist Dr. Darius Mozafarian, director of the Food is Medicine Institute at Tufts University. However, he added, the majority of the improvement occurred between 1999 and 2010, with no advances in nutrition after that. We have stalled as a nation, and that does not bode well for our health. If I was grading America on its diet, I'd give it a D, just up from an F. The number of adults in the United States who ate a poor diet decreased from about 49% to just over 37% between 1990 and 2020, a drop of 11%, while those who ate somewhat better nutritionally rose by 11%, the study found. A poor diet was defined as one with too many refined grains, processed meat and sugary beverages, including fruit juice, as well as ultra-processed foods full of added sugar, salt, and fat. Healthy choices such as fruits and vegetables are extremely low in this eating style. Intake of fruits and vegetables didn't increase at all over this 20-year period, which is pretty striking, Mozafarian said. An ideal diet included at least the daily recommended servings of fruits and vegetables, as well as more beans, whole grains, nuts, and seeds. Dietary guidelines, such as those from the American Heart Association, suggest eating 4 to 5 cups a day of canned, fresh, or frozen fruits and the same amount for vegetables. The nutritionally ideal diet also contained few sugary beverages, processed meats, refined grains, and ultra-processed foods, which are often high in added sugars, fat, and salt, the study said. Unfortunately, the number of people who ate an ideal diet, which included those 9 cups of fruits and vegetables, rose less than 1%, the study found. People often ask me, well, if the diet's slowly improving, why is obesity and diabetes still going up? It's still going up because only 1.6% of Americans have an ideal diet. We have a long way to go, Mozafarian said. More than 1 million Americans die each year from diet-related diseases such as obesity, cancer, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. While unhealthy diets and food insecurity cost the United States an estimated $1.1 trillion in healthcare expenditures and lost productivity annually. I think it is correct to emphasize that diet quality remains dismal in the U.S. There is no secret why Americans are experiencing epidemics of obesity and diabetes and declining life expectancy, said Dr. Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. He was not involved in the study. Nutritional advances were highest among women, younger adults, Hispanic adults, and people with more education and higher incomes who had access to private health insurance. Fewer gains were seen in men, Black, or older adults, and people with less income, lower educational levels, non-private health insurance, and food insecurity issues. Disparities in the population by education and income and race and ethnicity are the same or sometimes getting worse, Mozafarian said. The study found that people with lower income saw a 5% improvement in nutritional quality, while those with higher incomes improved their nutritional score by 16%. So in this case, It's the healthy get healthier and the sick get sicker. Or less well, I guess, as the case may be. The disparity often increases. Even if we're making improvements, they're not shared evenly. And the most vulnerable ones should be the ones that are actually moving towards the middle, so to speak, rather than just those that are already the healthiest getting more healthy. We do need to avoid just blaming the victims of the dysfunctional U.S. food system for the terrible diets documented in the survey, Willett said. We fail to educate students about nutrition in our schools and feed them unhealthy diets. Our healthcare system is missing in action almost completely. We allow advertising to seduce children into junk foods and beverages that kill them prematurely, and we indirectly subsidize unhealthy foods in many ways that make healthier options relatively more expensive and less available to low-income Americans, he said. There are easy steps you can take to boost the nutritional quality of your diet, experts say. Cook at home as often as possible. My top suggestion is to shop at the grocery store as much as you can, rather than getting your food at a coffee shop, sandwich shop, or quick-serve restaurant, Mozafarian said. Even eating at a full-service restaurant should be limited, he added. Prior research had his team finding that 80% of all food consumed by Americans from restaurants was of poor quality. Shockingly, even when we compared fast food versus sit-down restaurants, there wasn't a dramatic difference in quality, he said. Instead, try to choose minimally processed foods to cook at home and avoid the ready-to-heat and eat convenience foods so prevalent in the grocery store. Bring your lunch and snacks to work. Don't drink your sugar. Americans are beginning to get the idea that sugary sodas aren't healthy, but they have yet to make the connection that energy drinks, sports, and caffeinated drinks can be equally sugar-laden. Energy drinks, pre-sweetened iced teas, and specialty coffee drinks can have more sugar than soda. I don't see people walking out of the coffee shop with drinks with whipped cream on top. Don't drink your sugar. However, once sugary beverages are removed from the equation, only 6% of calories in the country come from added sugar in foods. In contrast, about 35% of the calories in the country come from refined grains and starches. Limit refined grains. Overall, the biggest contributor to the poor quality diet of Americans is refined grains at over 5 servings per day. Almost 2 servings a meal of refined grains, such as refined bread, refined rice, crackers, chips, and other ultra-processed foods, Mozafarian said. Whole grains still contain the bran and the germ, which is a nutritional powerhouse full of healthy fats, antioxidants, minerals, and E and B vitamins. Whole grains take longer to digest, don't raise blood sugar as quickly as refined grains, and contain more fiber, which can reduce the risk of chronic disease, promote weight loss, and improve digestion. Okay, well, America, congratulations for some modest improvement. I guess we're still keeping plenty of room for that most improved award, hopefully to come sometime in the future. Okay, well, next up, a story that gets at, you know, you can talk about the quality of food, but sometimes just getting food is a problem. This one, Fortune. America's kids are going hungry over the summer. We know summer is the hungriest time of year, says Rachel Sabella, director of No Kid Hungry New York, a campaign aiming to end childhood hunger nationally, which partnered with HelloFresh and YouGov to commission a survey on the topic. It revealed that 41% of parents struggle in some way to provide food when school is closed, and that nearly half, or 44% of parents, are more worried now than they were this time last year about getting their kids fed. Further, it found that among parents who struggle to provide for everyone in the household, 75% are at least somewhat concerned about the ability to afford food during school breaks, while almost half, or 42%, reported skipping meals themselves to make sure their kids got fed. The majority said they have either budgeted more carefully, at 60%, or cut back on other expenses, at 52%, to address the summer food concerns. So, food insecurity is still a big issue in America. And of course, while not having enough food is definitely a problem, on the other end of the spectrum, having a system of food that provides a lot of cheap, unhealthy calories can actually lead to obesity as well. This next story from NPR. Prevention Task Force recommends intensive counseling for kids with obesity. A panel of experts has updated their recommendation for doctor screening children for obesity. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force now recommends intensive behavioral interventions for kids age 6 and older with a high body mass index. The new advice replaces the Task Force 2017 guidance, which recommended that primary care providers should simply screen children for obesity. Nearly 1 in 5 U.S. kids has obesity, defined as having a BMI or at or above the 95th percentile for age and sex. Now, I just want to point out this is kind of an odd little statistical thing. So a 95th percentile just means that if you're in the top 5%, that's what the percentile means is 5%. So how can just about 20% of kids be in the top 5th percentile? Because they're using the growth charts from decades ago when children were not nearly as heavy. Prevalence is higher among Latino, Native American, and Black children, as well as children from low-income families. Fortunately, we know that there are proven ways that primary care clinicians can help many children and teens to address high body mass index. Our evidence shows that the behavioral counseling intervention of 26 or more hours can help them achieve a healthy weight and improve their quality of life. The recommendation does not include prescribing drugs such as Ozempic or the other GLP-1 drugs. There wasn't enough research to assess the value of medication for this age group. We're calling for more research into both the benefits and potential harms of medication therapy for kids and teens. There are three components usually involved in behavioral interventions. These are education about healthy eating habits, counseling on weight-related behavioral changes such as goal setting, and supervised exercise sessions. The task force gave its recommendations a B grade, indicating a high degree of certainty of moderate benefits. That rating also means that by law, the task force's recommended services must be covered by most private health insurance plans without a copay. That could be a big change. Of course, having insurance cover it doesn't necessarily mean you'll have providers able to provide it, or providers that will even recommend it. However, the recommendations will pose challenges for many children and parents. 26 hours of counseling is a commitment both by the child or teen and their parents. Obstacles that can limit access to this kind of care also include finding a provider who offers the intensive counseling or finding reliable transportation to get to the sessions. So, interesting to see where that will go. Stay tuned. Okay, well, next up, a story on kind of the more basic function of our healthcare hospital system. That's to keep people alive from, acute healthcare problems or emergencies. This from Medical Express. Replacing registered nurses in high-stakes hospital care is dangerous to patients, research suggests. A study published in Medical Care shows that substituting registered nurses, or RNs, with lower-wage staff, such as licensed practical nurses or unlicensed assistive personnel, in hospital care is linked with more deaths, readmissions, longer hospital stays, poorer patient satisfaction, and higher costs of care. Though hospitals often cite a low supply of RNs as the reason they cannot hire enough, the latest research shows there's no evidence of an RN shortage in the U.S. Thus, there's no justification for substituting less qualified staff for RNs. Rather than replacing RNs with less qualified staff, hospital leaders should focus on improving their work environments to retain RNs. With roughly half of hospital RNs reporting high levels of burnout, hospitals should focus on fixing the root cause of the burnout, chronic understaffing, and poor work environments, not replacing RNs with lesser trained nursing staff, and that the evidence shows is likely dangerous to patients. So this is a usual trope by hospital systems is that there's a shortage of RNs. But frankly, there are enough RNs out there. They just don't want to work in hospitals because of the poor working conditions. Okay, well, of course, we became familiar with the hospital system being overwhelmed during COVID, but here's a little story on a follow-up of what Americans think looking back on the pandemic. This is from Medical Express. Poll finds most Americans believe pandemic policies were a good idea. Despite all the grumbling at the time, most Americans now look back upon pandemic-era policies as a good idea, a new poll shows. A majority of Americans see four key pandemic policies as, quote, generally a good idea in retrospect. That is mask requirements in stores and businesses, 70%. Healthcare worker vaccination requirements, 65%. Indoor dining closures, 63%. And closing public schools, 56%. However, views varied across policies, the poll found. Only 42% of Americans say all four policies were a good idea, and another 37% say only some were a good idea. But only 20% say that all these policies were generally a bad idea. As might be expected, politics is a powerful factor when it comes to reflecting on pandemic-era politics. About 71% of Democrats say all four policies were a good idea, compared with 44% of independents and 18% of Republicans. Likewise, 55% of people living in urban areas approved of all four policies, compared with 39% of suburbanites and 29% of rural dwellers. However, within these groups, some policies were popular. For example, 62% of Republicans said at least one of the four was a good idea, as did 70% of people in rural areas. The poll found few total COVID deniers, with only 3% saying the virus was not a health threat to anyone in the pandemic. About 14% said it was a serious threat only to the elderly and frail, and another 45% said it was a threat only to those with underlying medical conditions, as well as the old and the frail. Only 37% said it was a serious health threat to everyone early on. Of course, this is a little bit of revisionism with 2020 hindsight. If for those of it, you try to drum up those memories, if you're willing to do that, this was a virus that was killing people. We didn't know precisely how it was transmitted, how bad it was going to be, how infectious, how serious, all that kind of stuff was really an unknown. How long it would last, all that kind of stuff. So, and of course, it ended up killing over a million people in the U.S. So and it killed, actually, the death rates in that first year were the proportion of deaths. In other words, your chance of being killed as a 20-something, actually, it went up higher for 20-somethings than it did for 70-somethings or 80-somethings. Of course, those death rates are very different. The death rates are a lot lower than 20-somethings. But as a proportion, it was actually more of an increase proportionally, percentage-wise, among younger folks than it was older. So clearly, I would call that as a serious health threat to everyone early on. But when you add up the raw numbers, of course, like every day in, quote, normal times, it's older people that are generally dying. So, well, as interesting perspective, I'm glad to see that a majority of the U.S. sees that generally taking the efforts that we did were actually a good idea. So, are we learning from lessons from COVID? This next story from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News gets at that. We're flying blind. CDC has 1 million bird flu tests ready, but experts see repeat of COVID missteps. It's been nearly 3 months since the U.S. government announced an outbreak of the bird flu virus on dairy farms. The World Health Organization considers the virus a public health concern because of its potential to cause a pandemic. Yet the U.S. has tested only 45 people across the country. I'm going to repeat that. The U.S. has tested only 45 people across the country for bird flu. So we can't really know what's going on with that kind of low level of testing. We're flying blind, said Jennifer Nuzzo, director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health. With so few tests run, she said, it's impossible to know how many farm workers have been infected or how serious the disease is. A lack of testing means a country might not notice if the virus begins to spread between people, the gateway to another pandemic. We'd like to be doing more testing. There's no doubt about that, said Nirav Shah, principal deputy director at the CDC. The CDC's bird flu test is the only one the FDA has authorized for use right now. Shah said the agency has distributed these tests to about 100 public health labs in states. We've got roughly a million available now, he said, and expect 1.2 million more in the next 2 months. But Nuzzo and other researchers are concerned because the CDC and public health labs aren't generally where doctors order tests from. That job tends to be done by major clinical laboratories run by companies and universities, which lack authorization for bird flu testing. As the outbreak grows, with at least 114 herds infected in 12 states as of June 18th, researchers said the CDC and the FDA are not moving fast enough to remove barriers that block clinical labs from testing. In one case, the diagnostics company Nilex Labs was on hold with a query for more than a month. Clinical labs are part of the nation's public health system, said Alex Greninger, assistant director of the University of Washington Medical Clinical Virology Lab. Pull us into the game. We're stuck on the bench. The CDC recognized the need for clinical labs in a June 10th memo. It calls on industry to develop tests for the H5 strain of bird flu virus, the one circulating among dairy cattle. The limited availability and accessibility of diagnostic tests for the influenza A, the H5 version, poses several pain points, the CDC wrote. The points include a shortage of tests if demand spikes. Researchers, including former CDC Director Thomas Friedan and Anthony Fauci, who led the nation's response to COVID, cite testing failures as a key reason the U.S. fared so poorly with COVID. Had COVID tests been widely available in early 2020, they say, the U.S. could have detected many cases before they turned into outbreaks that prompted business shutdowns and cost lives. In an article published this month, Nuzzo and a group of colleagues noted that the problem wasn't testing capability, but a failure to deploy that capability swiftly. The U.S. reported excess mortality 8 times as high as other countries with advanced labs and other technological advantages. A COVID test vetted by the WHO was available in mid-January 2020. Rather than use it, the United States stuck to its own multi-stage process, which took several months. Namely, the CDC develops its own test, then sends it to local public health labs. Eventually, the FDA authorized tests from clinical diagnostic labs that serve hospital systems, which must then scale up their operations. That took time, and people died amid outbreaks at nursing homes and prisons waiting on test results. In contrast, South Korea immediately rolled out testing through private sector laboratories, allowing it to keep schools and businesses open. They said, "Gear up, guys, we're going to need a ton of tests," said Friedan, now president of the public health organization, resolved to save lives. "You need to get the commercial labs in the game. If people who live and work around farms simply see a doctor when they or their children fall ill, these cases could be missed if the doctor sends samples to their usual clinical laboratories. The CDC has asked doctors to send samples from people with flu symptoms who have exposure to livestock or poultry to public health labs. If you work on a farm with an outbreak and you're worried about your welfare, you can get tested," Shah said. "But sending samples to public health departments requires knowledge, time, and effort." Of course, that's knowledge, time, and effort from both the person who may be the patient and the person who may be the provider. "I really worry about a testing scheme in which busy clinicians need to figure this out," Nuzzo said. The other reason to involve clinical laboratories is so the nation can ramp up testing if the bird flu is suddenly detected among people who didn't catch it from cattle. There's no evidence the virus has started to spread among people, but that could change in coming months as it evolves. "The fastest way to get clinical labs involved," Greninger said, "is to allow them to use a test the FDA has already authorized, the CDC's bird flu test." On April 16th, the CDC opened up that possibility by offering royalty-free licenses for components of its bird flu test to accredited labs. Greninger said the delays and confusion are reminiscent of the early months of COVID, when federal agencies prioritized caution over speed. "Test accuracy is important," he said, "but excessive vetting can cause harm in a fast-moving outbreak like this one. The CDC should be trying to open up this up to labs with national reach and a good reputation," he said. "I fall on the side of allowing labs to get ready. That's a no-brainer." Clinical laboratories have also begun to develop their own tests from scratch. But researchers said they're moving cautiously because the recent FDA rule that gives the agency more oversight of lab-developed tests, lengthening the pathway to approval. In an email to Kaiser Family Foundation Health News, FDA Press Officer Janelle Goodwin said the rule enforcement will occur gradually. However, Susan Van Meter, president of the American Clinical Laboratory Association, a trade group whose members include the nation's largest commercial diagnostic labs, said companies need more clarity. Quote, "It's slowing things down because it's adding to the confusion about what is allowable. Creating tests for the bird flu is already a risky bet because the demand is uncertain. It's not clear whether this outbreak in cattle will trigger an epidemic or fizzle out. In addition to issues with the CDC and the FDA, clinical laboratories are trying to figure out whether health insurers or the government will pay for bird flu tests. These wrinkles will be smoothed eventually. Until then, the vanishingly slim number of people tested, along with the lack of testing in cattle, may draw criticism from other parts of the world. Think about our judgment of China's transparency at the start of COVID," Nuzzo said. "The current situation undermines America's standing in the world." Okay, well, next up, got a story on antimicrobial resistance. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Farmers used banned antibiotics to fatten pigs despite regulations. Regulators have found that some farmers are still using medically important antibiotics to promote growth in pigs, despite a 2017 ban. Public health advocates argue that many farmers label growth promotion as disease prevention in order to bypass rules. FDA and pork industry officials are investigating, emphasizing a need for veterinary oversight in antibiotic use. "This is an industry that can take thousands of pigs, kill them, package them, and ship them in a matter of hours, but they say they couldn't possibly track actual drug use. They do amazing stuff. They just don't want to do this." Why this matters? Continued misuse of antibiotics in agriculture contributes to antibiotic resistance, killing over 35,000 Americans annually and endangering effective treatment of infections in humans. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, folks. Well, we're going to switch gears here a bit. America has an addiction problem. This from Stat News. Substance use experts are sounding the alarm on another addiction, gambling. Since a 2018 Supreme Court ruling struck down a de facto ban on sports betting, roughly three dozen states have legalized wagering on sports. 29 states allow gamblers to place bets online, effectively allowing users to risk the balance of their bank accounts on their smartphone. It's also a known contributor to suicide or suicidal ideation. Many people seeking help from gambling hotlines report suicidal ideation, and studies from multiple countries show that people who exhibit harmful gambling behavior consider or die of suicide at many times the rate of the general population. In 2017, a World Health Organization document classified gambling-related harms as substantially higher than those associated with drug use. I'm going to read that again. WHO classified gambling-related harms as, quote, substantially higher than those associated with drug use. Of course, the harms of drug use vary a lot, but of course, when we think of addiction, we usually think of drugs. As gambling continues to become more common, and as the long-running U.S. drug crisis continues, it's likely that addiction treatment providers will be increasingly called upon to help treat both conditions at once. Even before the post-18 explosion in digital sports betting, links between gambling and substance use were well documented. Those with a history of substance use are known to be at higher risk for gambling disorder, and vice versa. Now, nearly 1 in 5 American adults have an online sports betting account, and according to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, a roughly equivalent number met the criteria for a substance use disorder. That would be 1 in 5 Americans. The parallels between gambling and other public health crises related to addiction, like tobacco and the current drug overdoses crisis, are clear, both in terms of largely unregulated companies aggressively marketing known harmful products and in terms of neurobiology. The more we study gambling and the more we study substance use disorders, the more we appreciate that they go through very similar paths in the brain. The way one gets addicted to tobacco, heroin, alcohol, cocaine is quite similar to the way that one gets addicted to gambling or sex or the internet. Despite the gambling industry's immense reach, no federal agency is tasked with regulating it, and no federal funds are specifically earmarked for gambling research. The public health concern here is that you have a Wild West environment with no safety net and no guardrails, said Representative Paul Tonko. You have an extremely vulnerable audience that's getting bombarded with this advertising that is largely predatory in nature, with big gambling companies offering hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of free or bonus bets. Tonko, who has long advocated for high-quality treatment for substance use disorders, is one of few voices in Washington who has sought to warn the public about what he views as a dangerous situation with regard to digital sports betting. In 2023, he introduced legislation that would have largely banned advertising for online sports books. Earlier this year, he announced a framework for a more targeted proposal that would prohibit advertising during sporting events and common tactics like signing up bonuses, as well as a ban on the use of artificial intelligence to track user behavior and offer individualized promotions meant to keep them gambling. We really looked at the advertising component and mimicked what was done in the 60s to address a substance like tobacco, Tonko said. We need to address this with a high order of science and public health concern. Despite the problem's immense scope, some addiction treatment professionals may not be equipped to add gambling to their repertoire. In one survey, 82% of addiction treatment professionals said they lacked resources to share with a patient whose gambling was cause for concern. So we already have inadequate services for substance use disorder treatment for drugs and alcohol, but we are even more poorly set up for dealing with gambling addictions. And next up, a little story under the category of Americans living on the edge, Talker News. Study shows many Americans feel pressured to work while sick. The average American spends about 84 hours a year working while under the weather, according to new research. A survey of 2,000 general population Americans revealed that the average person works 10.5 days per year while feeling under the weather on average, and 47% admit they'd rather power through than take a sick day. For some, they may be more inclined to power through as they're worried others may think they're, quote, dramatic when they're feeling unwell. A third of the people felt that way. So this is kind of a big part of American culture, particularly work culture, that kind of just bull your way through it. And of course, that is supported or not supported by the fact that we don't have, a lot of folks don't have paid sick leave. And unfortunately, Many of those are service jobs that involved interaction with a lot of people during the day. So if you're going into work sick with some kind of contagious disease, yeah, not good. It's better for people to take care of themselves, and that's good for all of us. And next up on the loneliness epidemic, this from MedPage Today, majority of bisexual and transgender people feel lonely, survey shows. More than half of bisexual and transgender survey respondents reported feeling lonely, and these groups also reported the highest prevalence of stress, frequent mental distress, and history of depression, CDC researchers said. Among adults in 26 U.S. states surveyed in 2022, 57% of bisexual people and between 56 and 64% of transgender people reported feeling lonely always, usually, or sometimes, as reported in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report by CDC. These rates are almost double those reported by their straight counterparts at around 30%. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, as well as other experts, have increasingly drawn attention to the adverse effects of loneliness. Some have called for it to be treated like any other health condition. Loneliness was defined as answering always, usually, or sometimes to how often do you feel socially isolated from others. Stress was defined as answering always or usually to stress means a situation in which a person feels tense, restless, nervous, or anxious, or is unable to sleep at night because their mind is troubled all the time. Within the last 30 days, how often you felt this kind of stress. So, like with many other health issues, LGBTQ people suffer at greater levels as a stigmatized and disenfranchised population. Okay, well, next up on one of the pillars of health, sleep. This from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Survey shows 12% of Americans have been diagnosed with chronic insomnia. In a new survey commissioned by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, 12% of Americans say they've been diagnosed with chronic insomnia. Insomnia involves difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, or regularly waking up earlier than desired, despite allowing enough time in bed for sleep. Symptoms associated with insomnia include daytime fatigue or sleepiness, feeling dissatisfied with sleep, having trouble concentrating, feeling depressed, anxious, or irritable, and having low motivation or low energy. Chronic insomnia impacts not just how a person sleeps at night, but also how they feel and function during the daytime. Fortunately, there are effective treatments for those who are living with chronic insomnia, and these treatments can significantly improve both health and quality of life. Chronic insomnia can be detrimental to physical, mental, and emotional health, negatively affecting overall wellness and daily functioning. Additionally, chronic insomnia can lead to increased risk of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, motor vehicle injuries, Alzheimer's disease, and type 2 diabetes. The most effective treatment for chronic insomnia is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which combines behavioral strategies, such as setting a consistent sleep schedule and getting out of bed when you are struggling to sleep, with cognitive strategies such as replacing fears about sleeplessness with more helpful expectations. The cognitive behavioral therapy recommendations are customized to address each patient's individual needs and symptoms. While 6 to 8 sessions are typical, some patients improve more quickly. Okay, well, that brings us to the last feature of our show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and longer reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 31 bonus articles this week. First up, this isn't your grandparents' summer heat. The face of summer is transforming as people today face more frequent, longer lasting, and hotter heat waves than they did several decades back. This is a really good overview and stunning about how just in a couple generations, the climate change and obviously heating in this case that can take place. And bonus article 2, a related follow-up, the health science of extreme heat waves. If you're interested about that, good read. Bonus article 3, new rules will protect 1.4 million California workers from dangerous heat indoors. So there's about 39 million people in California, but 1.4 million of those Californians are workers that work indoor in potentially dangerous situations. So California is on the forefront of trying to provide help to those that might be subjected to dangerous heat during work indoors. Bonus article 4. Portable air filters in daycares can reduce indoor pollution by 85%. Because I have asthma and chemical sensitivity issues, I'm a big fan of portable air filters. This in daycares where, you know, kids are particularly vulnerable. That this is just a reminder that these air filters can reduce particulate matter and air pollution a lot. So if you don't have yours, and particularly if you have any kind of health issues, particularly respiratory issues or allergy-related issues, air filters can be a good addition to your home. Bonus article 5. FDA authorizes first menthol e-cigarettes. Meanwhile, Department of Health and Human Services still has not issued a final rule banning menthol-flavored tobacco cigarettes. This is kind of just the weird mix that we're in regulatory here. They've been proposing that for years and keep punting it about banning menthol-flavored tobacco cigarettes, which are smoked predominantly in black communities and also tend to be more attractive to youth because they're flavored and they aren't quite as harsh, so it allows cigarette smoking to start. Unfortunately, it does the same thing for e-cigarettes. We should not be authorizing them. Bonus article 6. Seaweed is choking the Caribbean's white sand beaches, fueling an economic and public health crisis. So this is basically analogous to what happened with Lake Erie some decades ago when we were pouring phosphorus in there and we were getting overgrowth. Now we're still getting overgrowth with algae. This is talking about when you just have tons and tons and tons of seaweed that are pouring on, clogging up the beaches, and of course they rot and stink, which causes a lot of problems, both economic and public health-wise. But this is also because we're pouring nutrients from farming and other sources into the ocean and causing this overgrowth of seaweed. Bonus article 7. New research finds most of the world's largest marine protected areas have inadequate protections. So there's an international treaty that's trying to get 30% of the ocean surface to be covered as a protected area. What this study has found, that those areas that are already determined and named to be protected actually have very limited protections. So the quality of the protections is as important or more important than simply just calling it a protected area. Bonus article 8, antibiotics and resistant bacteria found concentrated on ocean surface. This goes just to the fact that we live in a very connected world, and that when we're using antibiotics, those antibiotics themselves and resistant bacteria seem to be floating around on the ocean surface, and the concentrations on the surface are much greater than they are below the surface. So that can have obviously an impact on marine life and ultimately human life as well. Bonus article 9. The potential of micro and nanoplastics to exacerbate the health impacts and global burden of chronic diseases. So this is a really geeky read. It's a scientific article, but it's kind of a review article, and it goes into great detail and overview of what the potential damage is of micro and nanoplastics on our health. A good read if you're into that kind of thing. Bonus article 10. The delusion of advanced plastic recycling using pyrolysis, which is a chemical breakdown. This is a good example of where the industry gets the science wrong and is misleading, and then uses this kind of as a PR campaign to kind of promote recycling as something instead of basically reducing plastic production and use. Bonus article 11. Vaccine group Gavi seeks $9 billion over 10 years to immunize world's poorest children. So, great, let's do that. Let's immunize the world's poorest children. Although I think the most interesting part of this is that $9 billion over 10 years, less than $1 billion a year. I'm sorry, folks, that's actually not really a lot of money when you're talking about global health, and the fact they have a hard time raising that money speaks volumes. Bonus article 12, COVID summer wave grows, especially in West, with new variant LB1 on the rise. Now, today is the first day I've heard of the LB1. It's stunning how the COVID variants are switching out, you know, a couple months for this one, a couple months for this one, another month for that one, a couple months for that one. Now, these recent ones have come from kind of the same lineage, but each one of these new variants is more infectious, meaning it's easier to transmit it from one person to the other than the earlier ones, and we're seeing a rise. So it still is something to look out for on COVID. And this is actually a lot earlier rise than we've seen in the last couple summers as well, because we usually see a summer rise. And again, it's just another kind of the unpredictability. There's not been a completely predictable pattern for COVID and its little outbreaks and mini outbreaks compared to, say, something like flu, which is definitely very seasonal. Bonus article 13. Young gay Latinos see rising share of new HIV cases. So the good news is that HIV cases have gone down in the last decade, but the proportion that are among young gay Latinos is rising. So HIV, while new in my lifetime, has been around a couple generations, and we still have to keep paying attention and vigilance and shifting our priorities and resources in order to deal with the shifting epidemic. Bonus article 14. FDA chief says tech promises in diabetes go unfulfilled. This is a good example. There's all these kinds of continuous blood glucose monitors and such that promise an awful lot. But when you really look in the whole landscape of diabetes in America, is it really doing much good? No, not really. It's not really panning out. It's another example of kind of higher tech stuff often isn't distributed broadly or to people who perhaps even need it the most. It goes to those who can afford it or are going to healthcare providers that, happen to be recommending it, less based on the needs of the patient, more on tech promoting itself and the vagaries of our healthcare system. Bonus article 15, large-scale intensive blood pressure intervention proves sustainable in heart disease prevention. This was a huge study in China, and it showed that by just going to the doctor once a month and keeping track of your blood pressure control, that's actually effective, cost-effective, and workable. Now, of course, that would require more doctor primary care visits, but it's something that actually, even though blood pressure has been a huge issue for decades and decades and decades, a huge proportion of people who have blood pressure, it's not under control. And like I reported earlier in the show, worldwide, blood pressure is the number one single cause of death, according to the global burden of studies. They divide up things differently. But yes, blood pressure is a huge issue. Bonus article 16. Abortion is becoming more common in primary care clinics as doctors challenge stigma. So this is part of, abortion is just healthcare. And you see primary care physicians now more often offering abortion care in primary care clinics. Part of this is just to normalize it as healthcare. Actually, abortion care, particularly with the pills, is not that complicated. It's very safe compared to a lot of other procedures that they do. So this is a good trend. Hopefully, it'll expand much more. Bonus article 17, poor metabolic health linked to worse brain health. So if you have poor metabolic health or metabolic syndrome, which is basically having like high blood pressure, obesity, high blood lipids, that type of thing. Of course, our whole body's connected, and usually it's bad for one part of the body. And often we think of cardiovascular health, but of course, our brain has a very elaborate cardiovascular system too. So it ultimately affects our brain health. Much more connected than we often think. Bonus article 18. As they enter their 60s, Gen Xers projected to see higher cancer rates than boomers. So this is new cancer incidence. We have seen the treatment of cancer have modest improvements, although the decrease in cancer deaths in recent decades has been largely due to some better screening, but mostly because of reducing smoking. But this probably fits under the category of that each successive generation is less healthy than the one coming down the pike, so that is not good news. Bonus article 19, UK austerity spending cuts cost average person nearly half a year in life expectancy. So when you cut social benefits of all sorts, you pay a cost in both people living shorter, and of course things that usually kill you usually make your life worse before you die. So these kind of spending cuts matter. Bonus article 20. It's been 60 years since Freedom Summer, yet the fight for affordable, compassionate, and equitable healthcare is still going on. just another example that these battles don't really end, and particularly for public health in the South, it's an ongoing battle. Bonus Article 21. Study finds mothers pay more out of pocket when pregnancy crosses 2 calendar years. So this is a really a vagary of our system being driven by payment more than by need. So of course, a pregnancy is 9 months. Most pregnancies are going to cross 2 calendar years. And if you have deductibles, you know, for each calendar year, then you could be halfway through your pregnancy and you have to restart your deductible. So you would kind of hit twice. So it's kind of a particular, sort of arbitrary punishment that you get for pregnancy. We should really be supporting access and not making people go poor or bankrupt by having children, giving birth to children for that matter. Bonus Article 22, how a network of nonprofits enriches fundraisers while spending almost nothing on its stated causes. This is a good kind of a longer read just to get at some of the nefarious fundraising that's done around health issues just to make money, basically run some fundraising industrial complex and not really worried about getting money to the actual causes they're selling. Bonus Article 23, a tale of two states, Arizona and Florida, diverge on how to expand kids' health insurance. So both these states, Arizona and Florida, have expanded the child health insurance program, but Florida is asking for premiums, whereas Arizona is not. They both cost about the same. The feds are picking up like 75% of Arizona's and 70% of Florida's costs, but it's basically divided by Arizona being tightly focused on health outcomes, whereas in Florida, this kind of conservative ideology of that, you know, you need to put some skin in the game and pay for it, which, you know, isn't a terrible idea, except in the science of public health, we know that even having small amounts for people that have very little extra money, so to speak, it cuts down on healthcare usage a lot and disproportionately impacts health outcomes. So if you want good health outcomes, you just have to simply help people out. Bonus Article 24, why the FDA will have a hard time properly regulating cannabis. So the feds are descheduling cannabis, but also cannabis is regulated by states. So there's a whole myriad of patchwork of cannabis regulations, and even more so, cannabis is not one thing. You can smoke it. You can do CBD products. There's so many different permutations that regulating it is extremely complicated. And of course, now that we're just starting to really do cannabis regulation in recent years, it takes a while for that to kind of sort itself out. Bonus Article 25. Supreme Court outlawed segregation of disabled people 25 years ago, but change has come slowly. Yet another story of that you can make positive change, but to get that actually enacted and part of your culture can take a long time. And disabled folks are still experiencing a lot of discrimination and segregation in healthcare. Bonus Article 26. Journals that publish unabashed racist research articles should retract them. So there's this guy in the UK who published a lot of so-called research articles. This guy was just a public racist, and these research articles were very unscientific. And just the fact that it's hard to get journals to retract these unscientific racist screeds, basically, tells you a little bit about where we're at, some of the challenges in the scientific community, publishing in particular. Bonus Article 27, antibiotic resistance, an extremely concerning situation in sub-Saharan African children. So I raise this because antibiotic resistance is a huge issue, but also the fact that we're connected. Sub-Saharan Africa may seem a long ways away, but as you develop antibiotic resistance anywhere in the world, while bacterial infections don't travel around as fast as viral infections generally, they do travel around and become endemic in various areas and spread throughout the world. So we need to be concerned about sub-Saharan Africa, not just because it's the right thing to do as human beings sharing a planet, but because what goes around comes around. Bonus Article 28. Tobacco-like warning label for social media sought by U.S. Surgeon General, who asked Congress to act. So I just put this article up here. I'm not really sold that doing a warning label on social media is going to do all that good. Probably not going to hurt. Maybe a slight bit of distraction. But there are a lot of things we need to do. We need to regulate social media better so it's not just the Wild West. And in a somewhat related story, bonus article 29, New York Governor Kathy Hochul signs bill targeting addictive social media platforms. Our kids in are in distress, is what she says. So this gets an interesting issue. They're trying to do more to regulate social media, but of course, doing it at the state level rather than a national level is this kind of hodgepodge approach that makes it much more costly and complicated, particularly for those companies. If you have 50 different regulatory environments in 50 different states, it's kind of hard to run a company in that state or in all of those states. Bonus article 30, U.S. hospitals prone to cyber attacks like the one that hurt patient care at Ascension. So there's healthcare systems that where patient care is being reduced down to going back to paper because all the computers have gone down and such because they've had these cyber attacks. And of course, years ago, I can remember when that was all paper and it worked not so bad. But when we go back to paper without that being the normal way of doing things and not having those systems set up to deal with paper, it can compromise patient care a lot. So cyber attacks do affect the real world, in this case with hospitals and healthcare in America. Lastly but not least, bonus article 31, making art is a uniquely human act and one that provides a wellspring of health benefits. This is a great little read getting at if you want to learn about art therapy. And the fact that our brain actually functions most naturally and efficiently as a creative entity. And if we thwart people's creative activity, you are creating distress in their life. You can view these and any other articles I've reported on in this episode or previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.